Please be seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 050132, United Services Automobile Association versus James Stephen Bright.
May it please the court, Mr. Carl Jordan will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I would like to address three issues this morning. The jurisdiction issue, our no evidence issue with respect to the liability finding, and our issue or our point that the liability question, instruction accompanying that question that was put to the jury was embedded with reversible error. With regard to jurisdiction, our position is that Mr. Bright never established jurisdiction in county court at law in this case. Because, one, he filed a defective plea that had to be cured. Number two, he never cured by establishing that the amount in controversy at the time he filed his lawsuit was within the upper jurisdictional limits of the court. He did not plead his damages specifically until shortly before trial in response to a special exception, and at that time he pled for $1.6 million, 16 times the maximum jurisdictional limit of the court, even as Justice Duncan reasoned in her dissent. If you take out the maximum amount of punitive damages that he could recover in this lawsuit, the amount was still $1.3 million, or 13 times the maximum jurisdictional limits of the court. And almost and the vast majority of that amount, as Justice Duncan found, we submit, had to be attributable to damages that counted as the amount in controversy. Back pay.
Why is all that significant to the jurisprudence of Texas?
Your Honor, we think it is significant to the jurisprudence of Texas because we believe that when the legislature imposed maximum jurisdictional limits on the county courts, they meant for those limits to be enforced. And we believe that in this case, perhaps in other cases, there is, frankly, an amount of gaming the system that can and perhaps does go on.
Why do those limits vary so much around the state? Some concurrent with district courts and some 100,000?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question. I guess we would have to ask the legislature, but I know that it's $100,000 in Bexar County. And under the facts of this case, we think that clearly, the amount was way, way, way past the
Mr. Jordan, jurisdictional limit. You've indicated that jurisdiction with regard to the amount in controversy must be established at the time suit is filed. And you say that with some authority supporting you. Obviously, we can envision cases in which there's an honest pleading that is seeking under $100,000 in damages. But then there is some discoveries of some additional damages that perhaps were not discoverable at the time of filing suit, or maybe some new damages arose that then pushed the amount being sought beyond $100,000. What happens if there's an amendment after an initial pleading that's seeking under $100,000, the amendment a year later seeks $1.5 million? Surely you wouldn't say at the time of filing, since jurisdiction was proper, that the county court could enter a judgment for $1.5 million, or would you? And what would you suggest should be the result in that case?
I would not say that, Your Honor. You're correct. And I think the decisions of this court state that if the additional damages have accrued because of the passage of time.
Okay, put that situation to the side. I'm not going to give you an easy out.
Thank you. In that case, Your Honor, I would say that if there is an amendment that alleges either a new category of damages or increases the amount claimed in the category of damages that has already been pled, and it cannot be established that it's due to the passage of time, and I have some difficulty understanding what that phrase means in the cases as well, but it cannot be put into that category, then I think that the plaintiff in the hypothetical, as the plaintiff in this case, has pled himself out of court, as Justice Duncan said in her dissent.
So then jurisdiction is not strictly established for all cases at the time of filing.
That would be our position in the hypothetical you gave. Yes, sir. In this case, however, this is a much easier case because Mr. Bright pled for front pay damages. He said in his petition that in all reasonable probability, my damages will continue into the future, perhaps for the balance of my natural life, for which I sue. That's what his petition said. And by suing for front pay damages, he placed those damages into controversy. I would say in the hypothetical, Justice Wainwright, that you gave, if an amendment to the pleading places a different category of damages into controversy, that at that point in time, jurisdiction should be revisited. Otherwise, the expression of the legislature with respect to what types of cases the county courts at law should have jurisdiction over, it seems to me would be disregarded.
Well, your response seems to be similar to a situation that may have been filed in federal court and then defendants removed and kicked back to state court. Is that your position? Is it similar to that?
Yes, Justice Medina, there are analogies there. For one thing, in federal court, in determining whether the $75,000 threshold for diversity jurisdiction is met, the courts count front pay. So we've cited decisions in our brief on that. In addition to that, the courts look at requests for reinstatement. The federal courts do in diversity cases. And if the $75,000 threshold is in question, they put a value on that. I think some of the cases we cited in our briefs give an estimate of what front pay would be with a reasonable amount of time. Judge Rodriguez recently issued a decision where he said 3 to 5 years, we'll estimate what it is, we'll count it against the $75,000. So that's what they're doing in federal courts.
Do the federal courts use different standards in judging whether the plaintiff has met jurisdiction for diversity purposes versus whether the defendant's entitled to move? It seems like they do.
Well, of course, in federal court, Justice Hack, the burden is on the defendant because they're attempting to invoke the jurisdiction of the federal court over the plaintiff's objection.
On removal.
And they have a pardon?
On removal.
On removal, yes, sir. And they do go through an evidentiary weighing process where they attempt to determine if it's likely that the amount is over $75,000. But there, you
but
have...
But is it the same? Do they do the same thing when there's no removal? They're already in federal court and the defendant says it's not over $75,000.
I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I would assume it might be the same approach, but I'm not sure.
The D. Aguilar case that the respondent cites seems to set up a sort of a different standard, but I couldn't tell. You don't know.
I'm not very efficient. Although I would think that in that situation, again, since you would have a party that is contesting jurisdiction, would have the burden of establishing that there's no possibility that jurisdiction would exist. Here, we say there's no possibility that jurisdiction could have existed. The only way the Court of Appeals found jurisdiction, or the two judges in the majority found jurisdiction, was to conclude that front pay should not be counted because it was speculative. To us, we submit that was just clear error for several reasons. Number one, the statute on its face is plain and it excludes only three categories of damages: punitive damages and the like, attorney's fees, and interest. It does not exclude front pay, and there's no authorization for excluding any other requested monetary relief. So that's one reason. The statute's plain on its face. Secondly, the plaintiff pled for front pay damages, and by doing so, he placed those into controversy. Third, the likely to recover standard that the plaintiff, that Mr. Bright advocates here, and that the Court of Appeals relied on, it seems to us, is both unsupported and not workable. Number one, it reads the phrase amount in controversy out of the jurisdictional statute. It just reads it right out of the statute. It replaces it, we think, with a threshold type evaluation by the trial court, which in essence requires a mini trial. For example, in this case, in Mr. Bright's case, if the court had, if the trial court had gone through a weighing process to determine whether or not it was, there was a reasonable probability that front pay could be recovered, here's what the trial court would have had to think, would have had to weigh through. Number one, was Mr. Bright lied to with respect to the reasons he was given for the termination of his employment? That's why he said he wouldn't come back to work for USAA. So that evidence would have to be sorted through because that would determine whether the deferred remedy would be reinstatement or front pay. That's got to be weighed through. The impact of his declining to pursue employment opportunities, alternative employment opportunities that were offered to him by USAA, would have to be weighed through. What the circumstances of those were. He turned down two job offers from other employments that were in his professional field. They weren't manager jobs, but they were in his professional field. That would have to be weighed through with regard to mitigation. And finally, he took himself out of the job market 7 months after he left USAA to trade stocks on a daily basis.
If we were to sustain your argument and dismiss, does it go through the civil practice and remedies 60-day provision where they have 60 days to refile in county court, or what happens?
Your Honor, we have not briefed that issue, of course. However, we think we will have an argument that he will not be at liberty to refile if you find that the county court of law did not have jurisdiction.
Why is that?
It is because in this court's decision in Schroeder versus Texas Ironworks, I believe, the court ruled that the 60-day, or that the time limitations in the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act are jurisdictional in nature and not subject to tolling. I believe that the code provision that the Chief Justice referred to is limited in its application to general statutes of limitation.
Well, that seems to, you made some remark initially that there's some, perhaps some gamesmanship going on in these type of cases and in these type of courts, which seems to imply that parties who file the lawsuit, and perhaps by your suggestion, judges are involved in this gamesmanship, and you have a plaintiff or party who doesn't understand this game and then who has a meritorious claim, who sustains a verdict, and will be punished because the lawyer, maybe the judge, are in this game? Is that what you're suggesting?
Your Honor, I think the other side, whether you phrase in terms of Mr. Bright or his trial counsel or whoever, did what they did with their eyes wide open. They resisted requests to specify their damages in discovery multiple times until right before trial. Two weeks before they finally had to plead, they pleaded and they were 30 days out from trial. 2 weeks before then, they told the trial court in a hearing on the plea of jurisdiction that they had not, were not putting a number on their damages. And then 2 weeks later, they put $1.6 million on it.
Well, I guess the plaintiff in that case would have a remedy against the lawyer and there's malpractice insurance, perhaps.
If the trial court was without jurisdiction, the Court of Appeals should not have reached the merits of that.
We wish you could, Justice Heck. We think there are a lot of significant.
I said the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals should not have reached the merits if it was without jurisdiction.
What about the argument that if an amendment takes the mounting controversy beyond the jurisdictional limits for the particular court, that the trial judge could still enter a verdict, just limit it to its jurisdictional amount? What about that argument? I know it's conceptually at odds with the concept of jurisdiction, but what do you think about that argument? Does it fit under the statutory language, in your opinion?
I don't, Your Honor, I don't think it does. I think the court either has jurisdiction or it doesn't based on the amount in controversy, and I think the plaintiff decides what the amount of controversy is by his pleadings and his evidence. If I may move just very briefly to the no evidence points. I would say this on no evidence. Under Keller, under this court's decision in Keller, the court should look at all the circumstantial evidence on motive, including in context, most importantly. perhaps the most, the thing that the plaintiff relied on most heavily at trial with regard to his pretext claim was his argument that Mr. Bright had been lied to. Mr. Bright acknowledged, we think that, sorry, Your Honor, I'm out of time.
Thank you. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Doug Alexander, present argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. I think that the core issue and this jurisdictional issue is how we define the amount of controversy. And what I would like to do is to provide an illustration to the court as to why the definition they've arrived at, that is the maximum amount of damages sought, is the incorrect standard. We have been, of course, focusing all along on the maximum amount, $100,000. But, of course, the amount of controversy has to work on both ends of the spectrum. So I'd like to take us back to a kinder and gentler time when the district courts would decide smaller cases, and the issue was, did you get over the minimum jurisdictional hurdle of $500? And I would posit this illustration for you. Let's say that you had a case in which the plaintiff sued for $510. That's what the pleading wants. And then the defendant came in and said, whoa, no way. There is no way under the undisputed facts of this case and the existing law that this plaintiff can get a recovery of $510. Do we say in that situation that the damages sought are conclusive? No, we don't. What you're entitled to do, and this goes back to Justice Heck's decision in Bland, which goes back to the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Hoffman, is that you can come in as the defendant and say, by plea to the jurisdiction, I can demonstrate that this is a fraud on the court. I can demonstrate that that amount of damages sought cannot stand. And then we have the kind of hearing, Justice Wainwright, that we had in Texas Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda, where we have the summary judgment hearing on that. And let me cite the court to some cases that illustrate this point. One I'll cite the court to, of course, we argued this with respect to Dwyer in our most recent filing, but let me give you another one, Reinhart's. It is 401 Southwest 2nd, 274, a 1966 decision by the Austin Court of Appeals that wrestled with this case. And it's got great facts, and I'll just kind of lay it out. In that case, there was no question that the plaintiff, it was an auto collision case, property damage only, and there was no question that the plaintiff was absolutely entitled to $440. No question about that. The question was, the pleading was for $510. The plaintiff was asking for an additional $70 for loss of use of the vehicle. And the court went through a very lengthy analysis saying that, you know, the law right now is not entirely clear as to whether you can get loss of use of the vehicle damages. There's reasonable doubt on that question. So the defendant was arguing, you know, we're out of court. They can't get the $70, but the court says no. There's reasonable ground to, the plaintiff had reasonable ground to expect, this is citing Dwyer, under these circumstances, a recovery of $510, even though the jury ultimately awarded an amount less than $500. The court said, given that reasonable doubt, in cases where there's question, then we are going to give the doubt to the plaintiff. Now let's wind that up to our case where we're dealing with maximum jurisdiction. And let me give the court another.
Even if front pay damages are speculative, we're going to say they're within the realm and we're going to include them in the amount of controversy.
No, because now we have to use the same logic.
Thought I did.
Yes. No, you did, because here it is. The logic is this. Within the jurisdiction. Focus on the phrase within the jurisdiction. The plaintiff in my hypothetical going over the line was saying, I am saying that I have reasonable ground to expect a recovery within the jurisdiction. That is $510. Okay? That's between $500 and $100. Are you with me? Now let's go up to the $100,000 mark. Apply the same logic. I have got back pay that everybody agrees that I can get. And in this case, my back pay is below $100,000. Where the doubt comes is, can I get front pay? In a situation, if it's likely that I can't, and let me try another illustration that might help more on this. Let's talk about, and this is one that Pam Barron, I think, hypothecated very well. Let's say you had a personal injury case. And actually, I'll cite you in another case that really is dealing with this kind of fact. It's Widener. Here's the site, 14 Southwest 3rd, 353. And let me just take it through slowly.
Everybody agrees. Time, suit is filed, the damages are less than $100,000. But the $64,000 question is, can this plaintiff recover future medical damages? Okay? And at the time suit is filed, the doctor says, the physician says to the plaintiff's attorney who's consulting with him, I think it's going to be a full recovery. 100% recovery by the time of trial. Good news for the plaintiff. And so the lawyer asked, okay, I hear you say that that's probably the case. Are you telling me with 100-degree certainty that that's true? Well, no, I'm not.
But your analogies are completely different because in the first one, you're talking about whether there's a cause of action that's cognizable. And the second, you're talking about trying to figure out if the facts will get you there.
I'm saying that in both instances, the words that the court has used, for instance, in Dwyer, is reasonable ground of expectation. Both of them are dealing with a reasonable ground of expectation. Let me continue with my hypothetical.
One is as a matter of legal.
Once is a matter of law. Once is as a matter of fact. Correct.
But that's a big difference.
Well, it certainly is a difference, but it's one that ultimately comes back to the question of what's the reasonable ground of expectation. Again, back in my hypothetical, if at the time I'm filing suit, I have good faith reason to believe, based upon what a physician is telling me, in medical probability at that time, that my case falls within the jurisdiction of the court. But then I ask, are you telling me that with that with certainty? And he says, no, then I'm pleading for it. I'm going to plead for future medical damages because it would be malpractice not to do it. But then in the course of time, it turns out, and this has actually happened in Widener. The doctor says, you know, I thought it was going to be a full recovery. I now think that we're talking about permanent injuries. The case was amended. The pleadings were amended. And the court ultimately held there was jurisdiction. Now, they tried to do it under the rubric of, well, the damages increased with the passage of time. But it applies absolutely equally to the question of the $64,000 question of, can you recover those future medical damages? That's
Mr.
the big question.
Mr. Alexander,
yes.
in your logic, doesn't it flip the roles of defendant and plaintiffs in this hearing you're talking about? If the plaintiff files a pleading that's within the maximum jurisdictional limits and the defendant says no, front pay damages are not speculative, you've pleaded yourself out of court, you hold this hearing that you referenced, a la Miranda, as you said, and then the defendant comes into that hearing and says, Judge, we're adamant. The plaintiff has a reasonable probability of recovering front pay. And the plaintiff walks in and says, no, we're not going to recover that, Judge. It's speculative. Don't you flip the roles of the parties and make that a bit awkward at a minimum?
No, I don't think so. Because it's effectively what happens, getting back to Justice Heck's question, in the removal context. When you're asking for a remand, at least in the Fifth Circuit, and you ask, are there different standards around the country? Yes, there are. Some use possibility, other use. I mean, different courts use different ones. In the Fifth Circuit, they use the test of likelihood, which is why we suggest that that's not a radical approach, and it's the defendant's burden. Now, once again, back to your thing, is it awkward? Well, yes, except that there's no jury in the box. But in that case, yes, that's exactly what the defendant is doing, and it fits exactly with Miranda. The defendant comes in and says, no, under these circumstances, in all likelihood, the amount of controversy exceeds $75,000. It flips the roles, but once again, the courts don't have any problem.
And are plaintiffs' admissions from their experts during that hearing admissible in the trial? And
absolutely not.
Statements?
Absolutely not.
They're under oath, subject to cross-examination.
Well, and again, part of the problem is, and I don't want to get too hung up on this because I'm not trying to be cute. Let's talk about, back to my hypothetical. The doctor comes in under oath and says, at the time the suit was filed, yes, I told the plaintiff that in all probability, 90% chance that there was not going to be any future damages, any future medical damages. I told them that. I believed it. I'm under oath. I believe it. But you know what? 6 months later, and once again, this is Widener. This happened in reality. The orthopedist says 6 months later, she didn't get well. And in medical probability, I can now go into court and testify without contradiction that in all reasonable medical probability, She will continue to suffer damages in the
future.
And that
the damages were not temporary, but were, in his opinion, now permanent.
Now
at
permanent.
That point.
So
why
there's no contradiction.
Why is whether damages are speculative or not a more unwieldy standard than just a bright line rule? What did the plaintiff plead to determine the amount in controversy and whether that's within or without of the bright line set up in the statute?
If theirs has one advantage, it's more expedient. It's simple. No question about it. But it's not one that really fits with what we're talking about. And let me get back to my hypothetical.
But the statute says look to the amount alleged on the face of the petition.
Okay. And let's say, Justice Willett, let's say my face of the petition, in this case, ours was defective. But let's say that on the face of the petition, it says that the amount in controversy is within the jurisdiction of the court. That begs the question, how do you define amount in controversy? I will take my hat off to Justice Duncan, who undertook to define it. She said, for purposes of determining the amount in controversy, the question is not what a plaintiff will recover or is likely to recover, is what the plaintiff seeks to recover. You will notice, though, in her dissent, that within four sentences, top or bottom, there's no citation to any authority. What she had to do, because no Texas court has really undertaken to define it, is to go through all the authorities and come up with a definition. We merely say that that definition is flawed and doesn't fit with Dwyer.
How hard is that? The amount in controversy. It's not the amount that's reasonably recoverable, the amount that's likely, it's the amount in controversy. If the plaintiff leads up to $1 million or $1 billion, then isn't that amount in controversy? They may lose, but that's the amount in controversy, isn't it?
Well, here's the problem we come up with. They say amount in controversy is maximum amount of damages sought. And you saw, in fact, in answer to Justice Medina's question, I believe, that they say even if you later amend, it's the amount of damages sought. And that brings me back to my initial illustration. I plead for $510, and a court with a minimum jurisdiction of $500, is that conclusive? Under this test I just read, yes. But what Bland tells us is you can go behind the pleadings, and when you go behind the pleadings, Dwyer tells us that what you focus on in the doubtful case, with all intendments in favor of the plaintiff's jurisdiction, is what, and I'm just reading the Supreme Court's decision, the plaintiff might have had a reasonable ground of expectation of recovery. And I'm just saying that you apply that logic on both sides. It's not as simplistic as simply the number, but just pleading the number doesn't work. It is unwieldy.
You say that the jurisdiction remains. Why wouldn't you always file a defective pleading, not stating an amount in controversy, waiting for the special exception, and then, as in this case, saying, okay, the damages are $1.6 million. And once the court acquired jurisdiction, it has it throughout.
Well, because it doesn't have it throughout, and here's why. In other words, what typically would happen, and again, I don't want to get too hung up on the defects here. What typically would happen, and this is required by Rule 47B, is the pleading is going to say that the matter in controversy, exclusive of punitive damages, attorney's fees, interest, and costs, is within the jurisdiction of the court. That will be conclusive unless, going back to Texas Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda and Bland, the defendant comes in and goes, whoa, 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 time out. Not so fast. You're pleading that it's within the jurisdiction, but I'm saying that that is fraudulent, at which point, or a sham is the language that's used in Bland, at which point you have the summary judgment kind of hearing, at which point the parties come together and test that fact. The critical question, though, and I can't emphasize it enough, is then the question becomes, what do you mean by amount in controversy? And I will tell you this. The federal courts have wrestled with it. They've defined it differently, but they've defined it. And the reason they have to define it is that the statute does not. Texas statute is the same. It doesn't define it. So the courts have to fill it in. And, you know, bless Justice Duncan for attempting to do it without citing anything. And the reason, again, no slam on her, because it's not defined.
My question was a little different. What if, like this case, you just don't plead? You don't say within the jurisdictional limits of the court.
Okay.
You just say nothing. It's defective in that respect.
Okay.
Then the defendant says, you're missing something, we need to know. And then you come in forthrightly and say, well, our damages are $10 million.
Okay. Well, let me.
Or the amount in controversy.
Yeah. Let me tell you how it should play out in that situation, because we get to the peak case that we haven't talked about. If the
typically the way it'll play out of this, and it's a two-layer approach. I plead a defective plea, as you stated. The other side files special exception going, whoa, 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 you have not properly pled jurisdiction. Under Peek, I can then amend my pleading. My amended pleading will then say the language that I just used, the matter in controversy exclusive of X, Y, and Z is within the jurisdiction of the court. That's all at the pleading level. Then we go to layer two, Bland. The defendant comes and goes, no. It is not within the jurisdiction of the court. There is no question that the damages in this case are in excess of the jurisdiction of the court, so we have the Bland, we have the Texas Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda hearing. But then again, the question becomes, at that hearing, how do we define amount in controversy? And what I'm suggesting to you is a standard like the federal standard, the Fifth Circuit. It's not some, you know, bomb-throwing radical proposal. It's one that's consistent with Dwyer. Because what Dwyer tells us when we go back and visit that is if the plaintiff has pled an amount within the jurisdiction, in that case over 500, we examine the question is, did the plaintiff have a reasonable ground of expectation of recovering that? Now, there will be circumstances where the answer is no, where the defendant can come in and go, look, here's the receipts.
But the reason, why did the legislature have a $100,000 cap? Has to be because the idea was that county courts were going to be for smaller cases in some sense.
Okay, and I'm glad you got there because I've got a little bit of time. Let me go to that. Here's what
and
we...
And if the idea is you can do that and then instead you get $1 million judgment, that's not a small case.
Okay, let's explore that for a while because you've landed on an area that I think needs to be discussed. Here is the jurisdiction of the county court of law. The base is 500, same, and district court arguably the same. Okay, and then we go up to 100,000. It's concurrent all the way with the district court. This is what I think the legislature was doing in 1991 would increase it from 5,000 to 100,000. It was saying that we actually want the statutory count of laws to handle more cases. And in fact, they said, not only 100,000, but you can now decide punitive damages. And this is a time before we had caps. So they're saying statutory county courts at law, you're going to shoulder more of the burden. Now, let's look at their standard. We're now going to see that, no, the amount of controversy is the maximum amount of damages sought. Well, anybody who's ever tried a case or sat on a trial bench knows that the amount you plead as the maximum recovery is typically much higher than what you're actually going to be trying. And so what happens really under their standard is what you are saying now to the statutory courts at law is despite the legislature saying you're going to decide the big cases, you're really only going to decide small ones. That's why this case is significant to the jurisprudence of the state, because it's going to send a message to the statutory county courts. If you tell them that you can only handle cases in which the absolute maximum amount claimed is $100,000, it means that the cases that are actually going to be tried in those courts are the little bitty ones. You're making them a small claims court. And we're saying that that is not what the legislature intended. And so all we're asking for is for the court to engage in the type of analysis that Justice Duncan did. And again, my hat's off to her because she had to work without any court ever defining that in Texas, which is pretty amazing. But I think that when you struggle with it and you look at cases like Dwyer, you'll see that the appropriate standard is, and I don't have any pride of authorship, but it's certainly a lot closer to what I'm suggesting. That is, if you have a good faith belief at the time you file your case that the damages you're likely going to get are below $100,000, then the jurisdiction should attach at that point.
So then, if we have two identical courts, one in Plano and one in Edinburgh with $100,000 caps, the one in Plano is probably going to have jurisdiction of the same case, while Edinburgh not, because everybody knows you're going to get more for that same case.
That is so cynical.
It's a reasonable belief.
That's
what we're going to end up with.
I hear you. And I think, I think that every time this court has talked about our system, they describe it as Byzantine, abstruse. I mean, I'm obviously picking on you, but the bottom line is that, we're in a weird world in Texas when we have these limits, and all I'm saying, let's struggle and try to find a standard that really does work on both ends of the spectrum.
Mr. Alexander, we put the burden, we're seeking where to put this burden, but the plaintiff who files this lawsuit and files pleadings has the option to say, here's what I'm going to recover and here's why. Now, in this particular case, and in many cases, you can have a plaintiff saying, we want damages beyond the minimum jurisdiction of the court. Somebody accepts. We have a little gamesmanship. Somebody sends interrogatories. We shuffle our feet. We get up to trial, and we've still not had a hearing on this. Some courts might not want to have a hearing. Now, it seems to me like the parties and the lawyers, particularly the one making the claim that it's within this jurisdiction, if we just say it's up to you to show what you're claiming, wouldn't that solve most of these problems? You got to go in there and show us and tell that trial court and tell us on appeal, tell the other side. And if you don't, then you have the option of being in the situation you find your client in, and that is we got a problem here. Judgment, but a problem because you didn't choose to disclose fully. What's the fault in that approach?
Well, I think that the fault in that approach is, once again, I agree with you. You have to show your cards. You're saying, this is what we're pleading for. And I go back to my...
Okay. And let me expand on that. We just heard Mr. Keith say earlier, they, in a prior case, that they excluded one claim for tactical reasons. Certainly the plaintiffs are entitled to do that. But if they can pick and choose what they want to assert. So it seems like putting the burden on the plaintiff to say, here's what I'm claiming and here's why, solves most of these problems where we have courts of limited jurisdiction.
Well, and again, I think that that approach would be simpler, but I don't think it's consistent with what the court was saying with Guire, even though the inquiry is more difficult. That's all I'm suggesting. I think you do have to show your cards, and I want to go back to my hypothetical. And again, it's not hypothetical. It's the Widener case, the case in which I am pleading for medical expenses in the past, and I'm pleading for medical expenses in the future because my doctors can't say to me with 100% certainty that it's not going to be recovered. But I'm saying, Doc, tell me, because I've got to decide whether I'm filing this in county court of law. Today, as of today, do you think that she's probably going to go get well? Yes, I do. In all reasonable medical probability, it looks like to me that she's going to get well. Okay, then I'm comfortable filing in the county court of law because even though I'm suing for that element, the likelihood is I'm not going to get it. Okay? But then again, as matters develop, if that changes, does the court still have jurisdiction? I think yes, but I don't think it violates what the legislature is after.
That's not the case we've got here. We've got a case where we had shuffling of feet all the way up.
Well, I'm not going to sit there and argue against shuffling of feet. Okay,
right.
I mean, and I don't want to mince my words, and you're drawing on a bigger, canvas here. I think part of the problem is, and I'll be very frank with it, and I don't know, I've never asked. I think that part of the shuffling with feet is because of the language. We haven't talked about Rule 47B. Is the damages sought language in that rule? I mean, if somebody came to me and say, "How do you plead a case in a county court of law?" This is what I would say. And I see I've got the red light, and I won't put my hand over it. I would say that the matter in controversy, exclusive of punitive damages, attorney's fees, interest, and costs, it is within the jurisdiction of the court. But again, if I have a case in which I have reasonable ground to believe, in fact, I think likely that one of my elements of damages is not recoverable, it should not count.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Your Honors, I would submit that Justice Duncan did rely on precedent. She said that the amount in controversy is the amount of damages sued for. That comes right out of this court's decision in the Toon case, I believe, where the court said that the amount in controversy is the amount of damages sued for, the amount in the pleadings. And to me, that's just a commonsensical approach. If the plaintiff pleads for it, the plaintiff places it into controversy. And now, another thing that we don't have here is a case where the plaintiff came forward and said in an original pleading or in any subsequent pleading, the amount in controversy is within all jurisdictional limits of this court. Plaintiff never did that. Wright never did that in this case. He said he was over the minimum. He never said he was below the maximum. And then he wouldn't answer discovery about his damages until shortly before trial.
Do you think if you can't recover as a matter of law, that should not be counted?
I think that you're going back to the D'Aguilar decision, Justice Heck, and I looked at it while I was sitting at the table. And I think that's a possible approach, where in federal court, if the defendant who's removing says, or makes an evidentiary showing that the $75,000 threshold is exceeded, then the burden shifts to the plaintiff who is resisting removal to establish, the Fifth Circuit says, to a legal certainty that the recovery cannot be above $75,000. Maybe that is a rule that is worth considering in these situations in the county courts at law that would not be inconsistent with what the statute says on its face.
And one way the plaintiff can do that is to disclaim all damages beyond a certain amount. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I think if he did that in his pleading, then that might be appropriate.
Mr. Alexander said this was important to the jurisdiction because if we decide that you're correct and it sends a message to these courts that they should only handle small matters of controversy, what's your reply to that?
Justice Medina, I don't think that cases with damages up to but not exceeding $100,000 are the small types of cases that he's referring to, so I don't agree with his comment.
Well, it seems to me that if that were the decision, that the legislature could change these courts so that all across Texas they have the same responsibility as opposed to where they're mixed at this point.
Absolutely. I mean, whether they exercise their constitutional prerogatives wisely or not, or whether reasonable people may disagree with that, nevertheless, the political process for establishing jurisdictional limits of the county courts at law rests with the legislature, not with individual parties who might try to figure around that. And Justice Wainwright, there is a case that addresses your hypothetical about additional or different damages being alleged. It's the Garza case. I think it's cited in our brief. It's out of the El Paso court. And there a new claim was added with new damages, and the court dealt with it, though, simply by saying this is not due to the passage of time. I would suggest to the court that the passage of time test, though, as it's articulated in Continental Coffee, is not as bright a line of test, perhaps, as the jurisprudence of the state ought to have, because it, at least in some instances, I think, can open the door to efforts to try to plead around maximum jurisdictional limits. It may be that the Aguilar test is a more thoughtful way to approach that issue. We have some oral argument exhibits under tab 2 of that book. Just to make this point about passage of time, there's a diagram. Passage of time in this case had no material effect on the quantity, the amount in controversy, the quantity of damage being sued for, because while back pay dollars would increase as time would go on, front pay dollars would decrease. So dollars were really just migrating from one category of damages that had been pled for in the original petition to the other.
Any further questions? Thank you. The cause is submitted and the court will take